Welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, October 5th, 2022. I'm your reader, Janet Griffith. Starting on today's first page, our first headline reads, Judge asks if Cedar Rapids Police Review Board rules are biased. Ordinance requires majority to identify as people of color, by Marissa Payne. The Cedar Rapids man asserting that a rule about who can serve on the city's Police Citizens Review Board is racially discriminatory is asking a federal judge to bar enforcement of the rule pending the outcome of his lawsuit. Kevin Wymore, who is white, is suing the city and Mayor Tiffany O'Donnell over an ordinance that requires 5 of the 9-member board identify as people of color. Although U.S. District Court Judge C.J. Williams did not immediately make a ruling at a hearing Tuesday, he questioned why the ordinance lays out a quota for board members who identify as people of color. The Citizens Review Board was created in the wake of the George Floyd murder by Minneapolis police in 2020 and was intended to promote equitable treatment of citizens and remedy trends rooted in bias. Williams suggested the city could have considered race as a factor in making board appointments without requiring that a certain number of board members be people of color. I think we are living through times of social upheaval where there are pressures upon elected officials to act and act rapidly, Williams said. When a city acts in a way that is not constitutional, he said, that exacerbates the upheaval that exists in our society right now. Wymore filed the lawsuit in July in U.S. District Court. He is a retired Wisconsin public health analyst with a master's degree in public policy who volunteers to teach English as a second language to immigrants from West Africa. Wymore's attorney, Alan Ostergren, contends the ordinance outlining requirements to serve on the review board contains a classification based upon race. Advocates called for the review board, which provides oversight of local law enforcement, to be made up of mostly people of color to address systemic inequities in policing that disproportionately affect marginalized populations. But this policy provides that the CRB will include 5 members who identify as people of color. It contains no requirement that any of the CRB members actually be people of color, according to the plaintiff's legal briefs. Because those who identify as people of color may be better equipped to identify trends rooted in bias than those who do not, the city argues, the requirement that the board contain some members who identify as people of color rationally serves a legitimate government interest. The defendant has not alleged any demonstration of irreparable harm if the motion for a preliminary injunction is not granted, the city contends. There's no need for an injunction, the city argues, because no new appointments to the panel are expected until June 30, 2023. The city also anticipates amending this section of the ordinance before any board member's terms expire, according to legal briefs, so the provision in question will no longer be in existence at that time. It is possible there could be departures from the board through June, Williams said, posing the hypothetical of a member being hit by a bus. Since the panel began meeting last summer, 4 members have left the board. Some of those appointments were due to cycle off after 1 year, but others have parted in the middle of their term and left vacancies that the city has since filled. Ostergren said it would be different for the court to consider the city's plans to amend the ordinance if the city council was preparing to vote on specific language rather than an amorphous intent to change the racial requirement. The city has not justified its use of race in making appointments to the board, Ostergren said. The city cannot just ignore the meaning of its own ordinance when it uses race in this way, Ostergren said, taking issue with the city's argument that the identify as language in the policy means the city is not requiring people to be of a certain race. Though there are other slots on the board that don't have to be filled by a person of color, Williams said statistically the city has decreased Wymore's odds of being appointed. Commenting on the city's argument that the board's role is to address trends rooted in bias, Williams asked whether the policy itself inherently reflected a bias that only people of color could identify such trends. There's nothing in your policy that says white people need to be included, Williams said. Patricia Kropf, the attorney representing the city, responded that what we were looking for is a diversity of perspectives. As for Wymore specifically, Kropf said there were more than 70 applicants for the initial 9 board spots. I believe that's significantly more than we receive for typical municipal boards and commissions, Kropf said. It's not that Mr. Wymore is one race or another. Continuing on today's first page, next article headline is, CR woman who fatally stabbed a boyfriend guilty of lesser charge. Released on no bail, she faces up to 5 years in prison. By Trish Mahaffey. More than 4 months after court proceedings ended in a mistrial, a Linn County jury has found a Cedar Rapids woman who fatally stabbed her boyfriend, originally charged with murder, guilty of a lesser crime. Jacqueline Holmes, 38, faces up to 5 years in jail. After about a day and a half of deliberations following more than 5 days of testimony, she was found guilty last Friday of the lesser charge of involuntary manslaughter, unintentionally causing the death of her boyfriend, Tremaine Williams, 35, on March 4, 2020. A retired Illinois law and psychology professor who consults and testifies in cases involving domestic violence said during the trial that Holmes was a battered woman and suffers from its effects. She said Holmes told her about three men who physically abused her, including Williams. Carla Fisher testified Holmes said Williams kicked, punched, and choked her. There was a medical report from a previous incident, but no police reports to corroborate it. However, there were police reports to corroborate other incidents of domestic violence from two other men. The prosecution argued that Holmes delayed getting help for Williams after she stabbed him in the shoulder at a Southwest Cedar Rapids house. There also was testimony from an investigator that Holmes repeatedly changed her version of what happened that night during recorded police interviews. The prosecution also played recorded 911 calls where Holmes hung up on the dispatcher and then wouldn't answer the phone or provide information of Williams' condition. The dispatcher testified she received some information in the last call, which was 7 minutes after the first call was made. Williams died from blood loss, an autopsy showed, from the single stab wound to the shoulder. Numerous knives were found in the house, including a knife with a wooden handle, which a medical examiner said was the most likely murder weapon. It was found in an oven. This was the second time Holmes was tried for Williams' death. A judge declared a mistrial in the first trial in May when a potential juror told another juror about a previous interaction they'd had with Holmes. Sixth Judicial District Judge Kevin McKeever released Holmes without bail, pending her sentencing, which is set for December 13th in Linn County District Court. And our last item on page one today, headline reads, CR's time check connection to downtown making progress. One Ellis Boulevard Northwest intersection opens as another one closes. By Marissa Payne. The City of Cedar Rapids' multi-year endeavor to spur development in the flood-devastated Northwest Quadrant by connecting Ellis Boulevard and 6th Street Northwest is making progress before the 2022 construction season comes to a close. Effective today, the Ellis Boulevard and E Avenue Northwest intersection will reopen, Public Works said. But the nearby intersection of Ellis Boulevard and F Avenue Northwest will close Thursday morning for construction of a roundabout, which the contractor anticipates will be complete and reopened by the end of fall. This plan allows for one of the two Ellis intersections to remain open throughout the project. The full closure of 6th Street Northwest between 1st Avenue West and B Avenue Northwest is expected later this year for water service upgrades. A temporary pavement surface will be poured following the project so the road can be used during the winter. Early next spring, work between 1st Avenue West and E Avenue Northwest will resume. The full project is slated to wrap up by fall 2023. The Ellis Boulevard intersections are outside the Cultivate Hope Corner Store, the new nonprofit grocery store at 604 Ellis Boulevard Northwest, operated by nonprofit Matthew 25. The store opened in April, not long before construction began. The store experienced a dip in sales. Emily Bettridge, Matthew 25's Business Development and Marketing Coordinator, said E Avenue Northwest currently has parking available for the store's customers. As of Monday, the store's main doors facing Ellis Boulevard Northwest were open again and the sidewalks were complete. E Avenue offers convenient access to the store, and pending City Council approval, Matthew 25 has asked to make short-term parking spots closest to the store for our customers, Bettridge wrote in an email. The overall $6.4 million road project involves 1st Avenue West improvements from 6th Street Northwest to 1st Street Northwest and connecting 6th Street Northwest to Ellis Boulevard Northwest. The goal is to help traffic flow, reduce crashes, and add a connection between the Time Check neighborhood and downtown. Funding comes from various sources, including the local option sales tax that funds Paving for Progress, State Traffic Safety Improvement Program grant, Metropolitan Planning Organization Service Transportation Block Grant, and Tax Increment Financing. In addition to pavement replacement on 6th Street Northwest and Ellis Boulevard Northwest, the project includes a new street between those two roads, roundabout construction at E and F Avenues, replacement of a traffic signal at 6th Street Northwest and 1st Avenue West, medians on 1st Avenue West, and improvements to the southbound Interstate 380 exit ramp and L Street Southwest. And here is the first of several political items in today's paper. Iowa Senate District 40, candidates stress education, workforce. Newcomer Republican Chris Gulick faces incumbent Democrat Todd Taylor, by Grace King. First-time State House candidate Republican Chris Gulick believes he can be a voice for Eastern Iowans as a member of the majority party in the Iowa legislature, while incumbent Democrat Todd Taylor said he can work across the aisle to produce really good results for the people of Iowa. The candidates running for State Senate District 40, which covers Robbins, Hiawatha, and parts of Northwest, Northeast, and Southwest Cedar Rapids, prioritize education, economic development, and fiscal responsibility, but differ on how to tackle the issues. Election Day is November 8th. Gulick and Taylor both support legislation like House File 2085, which would allow people to get a temporary teaching license after completing an alternative teacher certification program. Gulick, 63, who was registered as an independent until last year, said putting subject matter experts with real-life experience in the classroom could improve academic outcomes for students. I'll give myself as an example, Gulick said. I've taught at the University of Iowa for almost 20 years. I've never had an education class, but I'm certainly a subject matter expert in the material I was teaching, and I had practical experience. Taylor, 56, said he is open to the idea of putting experts into classrooms but wants to see them receive adequate teacher training. I'm open to the idea of someone who is an expert in physics being an educator, Taylor said. I don't want to say just because you're an expert in this field, you're right to be in a classroom. To make Iowa a good place to work, live, raise a family, and retire, Taylor said he would listen to educators who are experts in teaching and encourage parents to get involved. He also wants to see smaller class sizes. Schools across the nation are facing a shortage of educators. We've got to stop vilifying teachers and encourage them to come to Iowa, Taylor said. Gulick wants to find ways to encourage the growth of programs across the state like Iowa Big, a project-based learning program in Cedar Rapids for high school students. It's easy to just throw more dollars at things, Gulick said. The hard part is looking at solutions and outcomes and the best way to get there. Having an educated citizenry is important. Ultimately, we're creating the next workforce for businesses and employers in the state. Gulick of Cedar Rapids served on the Cedar Rapids City Council from 2006 to 2018. He said his experience as a certified public accountant has prepared him to make decisions on the state's budget. Another of Gulick's priorities is to improve the state's workforce shortage by finding ways to attract people to Iowa. We have to make sure we get the word out around the country that the quality of life here is great and the education system is good. We'd like to get it even better, he said. Another way to do this is for Iowa to accept more immigrants and refugees and support organizations like the Catherine McCauley Center in Cedar Rapids, an education and refugee and immigrant services program, Gulick said. If elected, Gulick said he will be objective and independent in my views and represent his constituents. My sole reason for running for office is that Cedar Rapids, Robbins, and Hiawatha, we don't have representation in Des Moines in the majority part, and that's not good for us, Gulick said. We need a seat at the table in the majority in order to stand up for our communities here. Taylor of Cedar Rapids is seeking re-election to a second Senate term after serving 12 terms in the Iowa House. Taylor recently retired after being a union representative with the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees for 28 years, where he gained skills in negotiation, which comes in handy in the legislature, he said. Taylor said he doesn't think the district is any lesser represented by someone in the minority party. I'm disappointed in what I've seen in state government, and I still want to be a part of it because I think I can make a difference from inside, Taylor said. Taylor's other priorities include strengthening voting rights, renewable energy, broadband, and positioning Iowa to be a leader in biofuels, wind, and solar energy, he said. Taylor also wants to see property taxes reduced or eliminated for people on fixed incomes, like senior citizens. Wolf plans more meetings after lack of notice. Pipeline would go through Lynn, Johnson, Cedar, Clinton, and Scott counties, by Aaron Jordan. A company seeking to build a carbon dioxide pipeline through five Iowa counties, including Lynn, says it will hold a second round of public meetings after confirming some landowners did not get proper notice of its August meetings. Wolf Carbon Solutions, based in Alberta, Canada, held meetings August 29th to 31st in Johnson, Cedar, Linn, Clinton, and Scott counties to talk about a proposed 280-mile underground pipeline that could transport carbon dioxide from ADM plants in Cedar Rapids and Clinton to an underground site in central Illinois. But many of the people who attended those meetings said they had not been notified by certified mail and questioned whether the process was legal. The Iowa Utilities Board on September 23rd ordered Wolf to explain within 10 days how public notice was provided and verified certified letters were sent. Wolf acknowledged in a response this week that there were aberrations in the process they used to inform landowners about the meetings. During the course of its internal review, Wolf recognized and acknowledges some anomalies have occurred that potentially resulted in certain landowners not receiving notice by certified mail, separate from Wolf's efforts to provide notice by other means, such as the properly published public newspaper notices, Wolf wrote in a Monday response to the board's questions. Wolf officials said they didn't know how many certified letters had failed to miss their mark until after the meetings, when some letters were returned saying insufficient address or no such number. The company has asked the Utilities Board for permission to hold more meetings. Those meetings, if allowed, would be scheduled as soon as possible, while also allowing adequate time for mailing of new notices and publication of the same, Wolf said in the filing. Redoing the meetings could set back Wolf's proposal process. The company can't start negotiations with landowners until after the informational meetings and can't file a permit request with the state until 30 days after the completion of the meetings. But holding more meetings may be preferable to providing additional information the Utilities Board requested, including copies of the return receipts of all certified mailings. Companies proposing other CO2 pipelines in Iowa have resisted publishing the names of all affected landowners. Opponents want those names to help unite opposition. Wolf officials said they do not want to use eminent domain to force landowners to grant easements, and the company hasn't used condemnation on past projects. The company's proposal calls for collection of compressed CO2 at ADM plants and shipping it in a 16-inch underground pipeline to ADM's sequestration site near Decatur, Illinois. Wolf wants to find other industrial clients to tie into the project, which would be eligible for up to $1 billion a year in federal tax credits. At meetings in August, dozens of landowners spoke out against the pipelines, saying they worried about explosions, didn't want to lose productivity of farmland, and were skeptical about the benefits of carbon sequestration as a means of preventing the worst effects of climate change. Attorney General Hopeful Byrd uses transgender case against Miller. Iowa AG Miller, ad false and misleading on a number of scores. By Kayla McCullough of the Gazette Lee Des Moines Bureau. In a new ad, Brenna Byrd, the Republican candidate for Iowa Attorney General, accused current Democratic Attorney General Tom Miller of allowing a sex offender to go free because of a gender transition. The ad then says the individual reoffended with child pornography after being released. The ad references two articles in the Storm Lake Times that deal with the case of Josie Smith, who previously identified as a man. Liberal Tom Miller, after 40 years in office, he's making Iowa less safe, the ad says at the end. The Iowa Attorney General has the responsibility to keep Iowans safe and fully prosecute threats to our neighborhoods, Byrd said in a news release. Tom Miller refused to do that and used a sex change as the basis to allow a convicted child molester to go free. Enough is enough. It's time for a new Attorney General. In an interview, Miller said the ad is false and misleading on a number of scores. She's been a candidate for 9 months and has gone from issue to issue and has not gotten any attraction to her campaign in terms of why she should be Attorney General and why I shouldn't be, so she's desperate at this point, he said. The claims in the ad center on Smith, who was convicted of lascivious acts with a minor in 2014 and put on probation, but in 2015 was sentenced to up to 10 years in prison after violating the probation. Smith also had been previously convicted of sex offenses as a juvenile. According to the Storm Lake Times, Smith began treatment for gender reassignment and started using female pronouns in 2017. In June 2018, the Iowa Attorney General's office sought to commit Smith to a secure unit for sexual predators ahead of her scheduled release of July 2018. A psychiatrist's assessment found Smith was more likely than not to engage in predatory sexually violent offenses if not confined in a secure facility. The decision had been made based on assessments before Smith began transitioning. But in January 2020, the state's lawyers filed to dismiss that request because of new information from the state's expert. Miller and his chief of staff, Lynn Hicks, said the hormone therapy Smith was receiving, which lowered testosterone, was part of the expert's updated evaluation. The expert who evaluated Smith and originally said Smith had a high probability of offending later learned of the hormone therapy and changed the evaluation, Hicks said in an email. We could not go to a judge without the expert's recommendation. Miller said the decision to not move forward with the recommendation was made by a prosecutor's review committee, which he said unanimously agreed there was not enough evidence to pursue commitment. Smith was released from prison and subject to monitoring of her location and devices. She was also required to complete sex offender treatment. In 2022, while residing in Sloan, Smith was found with an unauthorized cell phone that she admitted to using to view child pornography. She was also found in previous circumstances to have been drinking alcohol and using an unauthorized tablet to solicit sex in violation of parole. Because of those violations, she returned to prison. Kush Desai, a spokesperson for the Republican National Committee, called the events a tragedy in an emailed statement and that, bottom line, Iowa needs an attorney general who will put Iowans and their safety above everything else, including nap time and woke agendas. Keenan Crow, the director of policy and advocacy for One Iowa, an LGBTQ rights organization, said the ad deals in harmful stereotypes, equating LGBTQ people as sex predators. Folks who commit sexual offenses against children need to be held accountable. I don't think anybody questions that. And their transgender status shouldn't matter in that at all. At least towards that premise, we are in agreement, Crow said. But they said, the ad is framed in a way that demonizes transgender people. It's doubling down on the kind of harmful rhetoric we've told these folks is very dangerous already, Crow said. 13 takes plea deal in killing near high school, by David Pitt of the Associated Press. A third teenager charged with murder in the drive-by shooting death of a 15-year-old boy outside of a Des Moines high school in March has agreed to plead guilty to lesser crimes. The plea agreement, accepted by a state court judge on Monday, may allow Gamaro Marquez Jacobo, 18, to avoid prison time for charges related to the March 7th death of 15-year-old Jose Lopez. Marquez Jacobo will plead guilty to being an accessory after the fact, providing a pistol to a person under 21, and being a person ineligible to carry a dangerous weapon. The charges together carry a penalty of up to 4 years in prison, but prosecutors agreed to recommend suspended sentences and fines and 2 years of probation, court documents said. Sentencing was set for May 30th. As part of the plea, Marquez Jacobo acknowledged he knew the March 7th shooting had occurred and that certain people had carried it out. I aided those persons by driving away from a secondary location with the intent to prevent their apprehension, he said in court documents. The shooting was allegedly carried out by 10 teenagers aged 14 to 18, riding in three vehicles and using at least six guns, from which they fired more than 42 bullets, toward several youth standing near East High School, Des Moines police have said. Lopez died from gunshot wounds. His sister and one of her female friends were seriously injured. Court documents filed last week indicated that Manuel Boiso, 17, and Kevin Martinez, 16, also have agreed to plea deals. Among the remaining defendants, one is scheduled to go to trial on October 17th and three others on March 6th. The remaining defendant charged as an adult has a trial date of April 10th. Two other defendants, aged 14 and 15, at the time of the shooting, remain in juvenile court. Bush to be honored at Hoover Library event, but media not allowed to cover it per agreement with former president's staff, by Tom Barton of the Gazette Des Moines Bureau. Former President George W. Bush will receive a humanitarian award and headline a fundraiser Friday for the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum at the DoubleTree Hotel by Hilton in downtown Cedar Rapids, but mum is the word. As part of an agreement with Bush's staff, media coverage of the event is not allowed, said Brad Reiners, communications director for the Hoover Presidential Foundation. Ticket sales for the fundraising banquet are closed. Proceeds will go toward a $20 million capital campaign to renovate the museum, which opened in 1962. The museum will present Bush and former First Lady Laura Bush, who is not expected to attend, its first Hoover Humanitarian Award for their work in Africa. The award was created to recognize those who have shown and provided meritorious and altruistic support to those in need, according to a news release from the Hoover Presidential Foundation, and is offered in the spirit of Hoover's efforts to save millions of Western Europeans from starvation starting in 1914 during World War I. Hoover, who was elected president in 1928, is the only U.S. president born in Iowa, where he grew up in West Branch. The former president and former first lady have worked to combat HIV/AIDS across Africa through the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief. The effort has saved at least 18 million lives through critical care and treatment since 2003, when then-President Bush authorized it, according to the George W. Bush Presidential Center. It is our honor to recognize the relief and humanitarian efforts George and Laura Bush propagated throughout the world through the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, in addition to Laura's health care initiatives for women, including breast cancer screening advocacy, according to the Hoover Presidential Foundation's website. Together, their efforts to continue the humanitarian work begun at the White House, support for women's health, serving more than 13.3 million people with life-saving antiretroviral treatment, tell an amazing story. The former president also will participate here in an armchair discussion with Margaret Hoover, the great-granddaughter of Hoover and host of Firing Line on PBS. One Dead in Powell Sheik Semi-Tractor Collision by Emily Anderson. One person is dead after a crash between a semi-truck and a tractor in Powell Sheik County on Monday evening. The crash happened at about 6 p.m. in the 4400 block of County Road V18 near Brooklyn. The semi-truck and the tractor were headed north on the highway when the truck hit the back of a grain wagon being pulled by the tractor, causing the truck to roll into the ditch on the side of the road, according to an Iowa State Patrol crash report. The driver of the semi-truck, 68-year-old Garland A. Roth of Grinnell, was killed in the crash. The driver of the tractor, 72-year-old Charles E. Griffith of Brooklyn, was injured and transported to Grinnell Hospital, according to the report. The crash remains under investigation by the Iowa State Patrol. There's a fairly extensive campaign almanac section today that details campaign news from the various political campaigns. I'll read as much as time allows. Grassley ad says Franken has no plans for inflation, by the Gazette Lee Des Moines Bureau. A new ad from Senator Chuck Grassley targets comments Democratic candidate Mike Franken has made on inflation, saying the candidate has no plan to fight rising costs. The ad shows a clip of Franken saying, "Iowa, our president, our senators have no role in that whatsoever," referring to inflation. If Franken doesn't understand that a senator can fight inflation, we can't elect him, the ad says. In a news release, Grassley's campaign spokesperson, Michaela Sunderman, said high inflation is the result of Democratic policy and said Franken's recent statements about fighting inflation is flip-flopping. How are Iowans supposed to know what Mike Franken actually believes when he constantly gives us whiplash, Sunderman said. Luckily, Iowans already have a senator they trust with a proven track record of fighting inflation and working to keep more money in Iowans' pocketbooks. Franken's campaign in a news release said Grassley's record had driven up the cost for Iowans, including a vote against capping insulin costs at $35 and voting against the budget deficit reduction in the Inflation Reduction Act. The release said Franken would lower costs by fixing the supply chain, stopping price gouging, cutting taxes on the middle class, and capping insulin costs, among other things. Time after time, Senator Grassley has voted against Iowa families and for policies that allow his corporate special interest donors to jack up prices, the release said. Franken campaign ad targets Grassley's abortion stance. A new ad from Democratic U.S. Senate candidate Mike Franken targets the stance his opponent, Republican U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley, has on abortion laws. Chuck Grassley has been trying to overturn Roe v. Wade since it was first decided half a century ago, Franken says in the ad. The ad says Grassley thinks politicians should be able to ban abortion without exceptions for rape, incest, or to save the life of the mother, pointing to an amicus brief Grassley signed onto the Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization Supreme Court case, which overturned the federal right to an abortion in June. The Mississippi law at question in the case banned abortion after 15 weeks of pregnancy. It allowed for exceptions for a medical emergency, but not for rape or incest. Franken says in the ad, Grassley supports banning abortion nationwide, citing a vote Grassley took to advance a 2018 bill from Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican of South Carolina, seeking to ban abortion at 20 weeks nationally. Grassley also co-sponsored that bill, which contained exceptions for rape, incest, and the life of the mother. Senator Grassley says one thing in Iowa and does another in Washington, D.C., Franken's spokesperson C.J. Peterson said in a news release. Iowans deserve to know which Chuck Grassley they'll get, an extremist who has supported national abortion bans and will continue to stand in the way of a woman's right to make her own decisions. Grassley Works campaign manager Matt Daler said in a statement the ad was chock full of lies and said Franken should take it down. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, October 5th, 2022 on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Dennis Virgil Gunn, 82, of Cedar Rapids, died unexpectedly on Sunday, October 2, 2022, at his home. Services 11 a.m. Monday at Tien Funeral Home by Chaplain Brian Reeves. Burial Cedar Memorial Cemetery. Friends may visit with the family on Sunday from 1 to 4 p.m. at Tien Funeral Home. Dennis was born on December 2, 1939, the son of Bernice Bevins Preston in Benton County. He graduated from Van Horn High School in 1957. On June 16, 1962, he married Helen Shade in Cedar Rapids. Dennis was an electrician at FMC until his retirement in 2005. Dennis enjoyed bowling, watching Western movies, playing golf, and watching the deer and turkey in his backyard. Most importantly, Dennis enjoyed spending time with his family and grandchildren and will be deeply missed. Memorials may be directed to the family. Online condolences can be left at tnfuneralhome.com. Donald Don Eugene Smith of Anamosa went to be with the Lord on Saturday, October 1, 2022. Don was born June 6, 1927, and passed away at the age of 95. He grew up and went to school in Ladora, Iowa. After earning his business degree in college, he worked with the public in retail and apartment management in Iowa, Alabama, and Indiana. Don also worked at Collins Radio in Cedar Rapids. Don took his career in business very seriously, taking pride and making sure anything he was part of doing was done well and done completely. In his retirement, he showed his strength and dedication, volunteering his time and energy to those who worked and lived at the Anamosa Care Center. A public graveside with military rites will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, October 8, 2022, at the Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery, Garden of Eternal Love. Online condolences may be left at cedarmemorial.com under obituaries. Brooke Dawn Wagner of Marion, Iowa, passed away at her home. "You Light Up My Life" was her favorite song. Ironically, it was Brooke who lit up the lives of everyone she met. She was full of love, laughter, hugs, and conversations. Brooke Dawn Wagner passed away peacefully in her sleep on Monday, October 3, 2022. She recently turned 60 and enjoyed another one of her favorite birthday celebrations. Brooke enjoyed stints of work, including years at the Linn County Sheltered Workshop. She proudly retired from the mailing department at Aegon. Brooke thoroughly enjoyed her staff and many friends at her work, and socializing over lunches really made her day. Everyone loved Brooke, and she was a loving friend to all. A special thanks to old neighbors, staff, group home roommates, nurses, doctors, and especially family members who made Brooke feel so special and loved her entire life. A celebration of life will be held in Cedar Rapids next spring. Memorials for Brooke can be made to Discovery Living in Cedar Rapids. Online condolences can be sent to the family at newhousefuneralservice.com. Robeck Newhouse Funeral Service is assisting the family in their time of need. Daniel Lee Richmond, 80, of Cedar Rapids, formerly of South Sioux City, Nebraska, passed away Friday, September 3, 2022, at an Orillia, Iowa care center. Services will be held at 11 a.m. Thursday, October 6th at Meyer Brothers Morningside Chapel. Visitation with the family will be Wednesday, October 5th, 2022, from 5 to 7 p.m., with a prayer service at 7 p.m. at the funeral home. Burial will be at Memorial Park Cemetery. Online condolences may be given at meyerbroschapels.com. Dan was born September 11, 1942, the son of James and Sarah Louise Clark Richmond. He grew up loving cars and was the owner of American Auto Sales in Denison, Iowa, wholesaled cars at Miller's Auto in Omaha, Nebraska, and owned Richmond's Auto Max in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Danny was a member of Iowa Automobile Dealer Association for many years. Dan's passions in life were making people laugh with his jokes, his work, his faith, and his grandchildren. He was musically gifted and able to play any instrument that he picked up. Donald J. Meisel, 89, of Marengo, formerly of Amana, passed away Saturday, September 17, 2022, in Leesburg, Florida. A memorial service will be held at 10:30 a.m. Monday, October 10, 2022, at the First Presbyterian Church, Marengo, with Reverend Annie Thorne and Reverend Diane Voorhees officiating. The family will receive friends from 4 to 7 p.m. Sunday, October 9th, 2022, at Closter Funeral Home, Marengo. Burial will be in the Marengo Cemetery with military honors conducted by the American Legion Post No. 76 and the United States Navy Honor Guard. In lieu of flowers, a memorial fund has been established. Donald James Meisel was born April 21, 1933 in Marengo, the son of Michael and Blanche Holly Meisel. He graduated from Marengo High School in 1953. Following graduation, he enlisted in the United States Navy, served during the Korean War as a member of the USS Shields DD-596. After completing his Navy enlistment, Don continued his education at Iowa State University. He was united in marriage to Marilyn Stupp on September 5, 1959 at the Little Brown Church in Nashua. Don was a longtime resident of Amana before moving to Marengo. He was employed at Collins Radio for 33 years as a commercial artist. Don was a member of the Masonic Lodge No. 364 Fairfax and the past master of the Marengo Lodge before it closed. Don also was a member of the Marengo American Legion Post No. 76, president of the Iowa County Historical Society, Amana Heritage Society, and the Amana Arts Guild. Evelyn Bolger, 97, of Marengo, passed away October 3, 2022, peacefully at Rosehaven Nursing Home, surrounded by love from her family. Closter Funeral Home Marengo is assisting the family with arrangements. Evelyn was born December 22, 1924, at home in Ladora, Iowa. She married Wayne Bolger on October 16, 1945. They farmed north of Marengo until Wayne retired. Evelyn was a cook at the Iowa Valley Elementary School for 23 years. A celebration of life service will be held Saturday, October 8, 2022, at 11 a.m. at the Victor Baptist Church, Victor, Iowa. Visitation will take place from 9 a.m. until service time. Pastor Dan Andrews will be officiating. Burial will be in the Ohio Cemetery, rural Ladora, Iowa. Memorials can be contributed to the Victor Baptist Church or Partnership Resources, Inc., St. Louis Park, Minnesota. The family would like to thank Rosehaven Nursing Home and Hospice for their care. Online condolences may be left at closerfuneralhome.com. Gail Diane Tedrow, 74, of Cedar Rapids, formerly of Scotch Grove, died Wednesday, September 28, 2022. A celebration of life will be held from 3 to 7 p.m. October 7th at the Sill Barn, Camp Courageous, 12007 190th Street, Monticello. Gail grew up in Scotch Grove. She graduated from Monticello High School in 1966 and received an Associate of Arts degree from San Joaquin Dental College in 1993. She lived in Monticello, Stockton, California, and Cedar Rapids. She worked in the insurance industry for many years, including at Aegon in Cedar Rapids, until she retired in 2016. She loved spending time with her family and four grandchildren. Jean A. Thomas Hocker Urban, 77, lifetime resident of Iowa City and the Williamsburg areas, died Saturday, October 1, 2022. Memorial services will be held at 3 p.m. Saturday, October 9, 2022, at Gay and Chia Funeral and Cremation Service. A time of visitation will follow the services for family and friends to visit. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations can be made in Jean's memory to Iowa City Hospice. To share a thought, memory, or condolence with her family, please visit Gay and Chia Funeral Home and Cremation Service website at gayandchia.com. Jean Ann Thomas was born February 28, 1945 in Iowa City, Iowa, the daughter of Edward W. and Catherine K. Myers Thomas. Attending Iowa City schools, she graduated from University High School. Growing up on the family farm and one of three daughters, Jean was not only familiar with chores, she did everything there was to do on a dairy and hog farm, and then some. Jean returned to live in this area after living in Williamsburg for many years, raising her family. Jean had a strong faith, strong work ethic, enjoyed traveling with her husband, fishing, watching and feeding the birds, and listening to music. Jean was a devoted daughter, mother, grandmother, and friend. John D. Kester, 57, of Marion, Iowa, passed away on Sunday, October 2, 2022, at Unity Point St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids. In agreement with his wishes, cremation has taken place. A celebration of John's life will be open from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. on Saturday, October 8, 2022, at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion. John was born on January 2, 1965, in Manchester, Iowa, the son of Lewis Edward and Vanetta May Vannetta May Wall Kester. He grew up on the family farm near Lamont, Iowa. John was a 1983 graduate of Starmont High School and went on to attend the University of Northern Iowa, graduating in 1987 with a degree in computer science. In May of 1990, John was united in marriage to Christy Paulson. They later divorced. John worked at St. Luke's Hospital as a computer programmer from 1987 to 1998. He then went on to own and operate an IT consulting business called Innovative Software Solutions with his best friend Kurt Kraus until 2007. John then worked for NXT Bank in cybersecurity until 2018. He also worked for Latta Harris as a seasonal tax preparer for several years. Memorials in John's memory may be directed to either his family or to St. Luke's Foundation at 810 First Avenue Northeast, 2nd floor, Cedar Rapids, Iowa, 52402. Please share a memory of John at murdochfuneralhome.com under obituaries. Mary Lou Steiger, 73, of Iowa City, died on Saturday, October 1, 2022, at Mercy Hospital in Iowa City. Visitation will be from 10 to 11:30 a.m. at Lansing Funeral and Cremation Service in Iowa City, with a graveside committal service following at Memory Garden Cemetery, Iowa City. Family invites guests to join them for a luncheon following the burial at the VFW, 609 Hollywood Boulevard, Iowa City. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to the Steger's family in care of Dorothy Deer. Kathleen Cat Aaron Brown of Iowa City passed away unexpectedly on September 27, 2022 at age 38. Kathleen was born on May 13, 1984 in Atlanta, Georgia, to Lori Ray, a registered nurse, and Randy Brown, a high school teacher. Some of Kathleen's happiest childhood years unfolded on Brookland Park Drive in Iowa City. There, she and twins Shirley and Marion Stern became inseparable friends and remained close even when, as adults, they lived many states away from one another. Growing up, Kathleen participated in many sports teams and clubs. To swimming, cheerleading, judo, and softball, she brought her athleticism and spark. Kathleen and her father often went on camping trips when she was young, and they participated in RAGBRAI together. Near the top of her list of favorite experiences was a tour of the national parks in the Southwest with her mother. In Joshua Evans, to whom she was known as Kitty, she found a special partner who cared for and devoted himself to her long before and then during the COVID pandemic. Together, they made a home where friends found their way to many an informal get-together. A gathering of remembrance for Kathleen will be held at Lansing Funeral Home in Iowa City on Saturday, October 8th from 3 to 5 p.m. with a service at 4:30 p.m. A private family burial will be held at Oakland Cemetery at a later date. In lieu of flowers, donations in Kathleen's honor may be made to the Iowa Humane Alliance or Paws and More. Leo Lee Dennison, 7-month-old son of Angel Dennison and Mitchell Gray of Central City, Iowa, gained his heavenly wings on Friday, September 30, 2022. A memorial service will be held at 6 p.m. on Thursday, October 6, 2022 at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Central City, with a visitation 1 hour prior to the service. Leo was born on February 23, 2022 in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. He was a very happy baby. Leo loved being outside and was just learning to crawl. In death, Leo was a donor and gave the gift of life. Memorials may be directed to the family. Please place your condolences at murdochfuneralhome.com under obituaries. Linda Susan Schick Liebke, 73, of Coralville, Iowa, died Saturday, October 1, 2022, at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Linda was born May 27, 1949, in Waverly, Iowa, to Edwin and Barbara Anderson Schick. After the family moved to Dubuque, Iowa, she attended Dubuque Senior High. Linda went on to Wartburg College and received her undergraduate degree from the University of Iowa. She married Stanley Liebke on December 24, 1969. In 1973, Linda began a career at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. She served as Administrative Services Specialist and Human Resource Unit Representative for Social, Patient, and Family Services there before retiring in 2012. Visitation will be at Christ the King Lutheran Church, 325 Mormon Trek Boulevard, Iowa City, Iowa, at 10 a.m. on Wednesday, October 12, 2022, with a memorial service to follow at 11 a.m. A lunch will be served following the service. In lieu of flowers, memorial contributions in memory of Linda may be made to support the School of Social Work Development Fund at the University of Iowa, payable to the University of Iowa Center for Advancement, P.O. Box 4550, Iowa City, Iowa 52244, or at givetoiowa.org. Margaret Jean Swanson McCusker, 93, of Manchester, Iowa, passed away on Monday, October 3, 2022, at the Good Neighbor Home in Manchester. She was born on January 31, 1929, in Manchester, the daughter of Harry and Elma Anderson Swanson. Jean was raised in Prairie Township, Delaware County, and graduated from Manchester High School. On October 25, 1949, Jean was united in marriage to Francis Frank Arthur McCusker at St. Patrick Catholic Church in Ryan. Five children were born to this union. Online condolences may be sent to leonardmullerfh.com. Massive Christian burial, 11 a.m. on Thursday, October 6, 2022, at St. Mary Catholic Church in Manchester, Iowa, with Reverend Gabriel Anderson officiating. Visitation, 4 to 7 p.m. on Wednesday, October 5, 2022, at the Gathering Place in Manchester, Iowa, with a rosary service at 3:30 p.m. Friends may also call from 9:30 to 10:45 a.m. Thursday at St. Mary Catholic Church in Manchester. Interment, Calvary Cemetery, Ryan, Iowa. Patricia Ruber Martin of Monona, Iowa, died on Saturday, October 1, 2022, at Mercy One Hospital, Elkader, Iowa, of cervical cancer. A graveside service will be at 1 p.m. on Saturday, October 8, 2022, at the Monona Cemetery, Monona, Iowa, with a visitation to follow from 2 to 4 p.m. at Leonard Grau Funeral Home, Monona, Iowa. Pat was born on November 3, 1937, in Olwine, Iowa, to Ted and Bernitha Ruber. She received her education at Fremont No. 6, the public school located in Westgate, and Maynard High School, graduating in 1955. She graduated from Upper Iowa University in Fayette in 1958. On August 15, 1958, Pat and Roger Martin of Maynard were married in St. Peter Lutheran Church in Westgate. Two sons were born to the couple, Bill and Jeff. Pat and Roger lived in Brighton and Fairfield while Roger finished college, after which they lived in Monona, Applington, and Coggin. They returned to Monona in 1977, where they taught until retirement. Pat has asked that memorial donations be made to the Monona Butterfly Gardens and Trails, Murphy Helwig Library, or the Northeast Iowa Humane Society. Leonard Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Monona, Iowa, is assisting the family with arrangements. Richard L. Bull, 81, of Palo, passed away October 3, 2022, at the Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy in Hiawatha. Visitation, 10 to 11 a.m., Thursday, October 6, 2022, at Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories. Funeral service, 11 a.m., Thursday, October 6, 2022, at Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories. Private interment, Palo Cemetery. Richard was born on May 13, 1941, in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, the son of Gerald and Ethel Packingham Bull. He graduated from Palo High School. Dick was united in marriage to Judy Leonard on May 27, 1962, at the church at Covington. He was a lifelong farmer. Dick was a member of Palo United Methodist Church and was a 50-year member of Benton City Masonic Lodge No. 81 in Shelbsburg, Iowa. In addition, he had served as chairman of District 6 Township Fire Department. Dick also was a beef producer and pork producer in Linn County. He was an avid fan of the Chicago Cubs, Chicago Bears, Chicago Bulls, and Iowa Hawkeyes. Over the years, he made several trips to the Black Hills in South Dakota. Memorials may be directed to the family. Online condolences are welcome at cedarmemorial.com. Thomas Harold Gordon II, 64, of Shelbsburg, Iowa, passed away on Friday, September 30, 2022. Visitation will be held on Saturday, October 8, 2022, from 4 to 6 p.m. at Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home. Funeral services will be held on Sunday, October 9, 2022, at noon at Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories. A final burial service will be held at Oakwood Cemetery in Adrian, Michigan, at a later date. Thomas was born on November 23, 1957, in Arlington, Virginia, to Thomas and Mary Varner Gordon. He was raised in Adrian, Michigan, with his brothers Mike and Jeff and sister Sandy, where he swam for and graduated Adrian High School in 1976. That same year, he enlisted in the U.S. Navy and into their nuclear power school, where he went on to serve aboard the submarine USS Pintado. He sailed the Pacific and Arctic Oceans and took part in the Navy's 13th submarine mission to the North Pole. He moved to Cedar Rapids, Iowa in 1984 to start a family and work at the Duane Arnold Nuclear Plant, eventually working his way up to shift manager and senior reactor operator. During his illustrious career, he wrote and established industry-wide safety standards, trained hundreds of other operators, and set national performance records. He retired in 2020. Shirley Sue Irene Fuller, 94, passed away Sunday, October 2, 2022, at the Hiawatha Care Center. A visitation will be held Friday, October 7th from 2 p.m. until time of funeral service, 3 p.m. at Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories. Sue was born on August 11, 1928 in Aurora, Iowa. She graduated from Lamont Consolidated Schools in 1946 and married the love of her life, Donald Merritt Fuller, on June 28, 1947 in Independence, Iowa. She was a loving wife, mother, grandmother, sister, and friend. She will be greatly missed. Online condolences may be directed to the family at cedarmemorial.com. That concludes today's obituaries. On today's editorial page, there are two columns by Iowa Senate candidates. I will read as much of each as time allows. This one is from Molly Donahue for Iowa Senate District 37, Passion for Helping Working People in Iowa. I announced my run for the Senate minutes after the special session had completed redistricting. I made that decision based on the open seat with the retirements of longtime Senator Rob Hogue and Senator Liz Mathis and the opportunity to expand on my service to my community. This move will allow me to continue to serve the people that I've had the honor of representing in the House over the past two sessions in Marion and parts of Southeast Cedar Rapids, adding parts of Northeast Cedar Rapids. In the Senate, I will be able to continue to expand on the rapport that I've built with the city and county governments, as well as the people and small business owners in the community. The current climate in politics has been divisive, and it's time that the people are put first. That is why I will work to improve the lives of the people in my community by working on the most important issues today in Iowa, which are lowering costs for families, protecting reproductive rights for women, and public education. I ran for office because of my passion for helping the working people in my community, which includes lowering costs and reducing living expenses for families and small business owners while finding ways to attract new jobs and young people back to Iowa. Increasing wages, lowering taxes for the middle class, and expanding access to affordable child care is where I'll begin. Reproductive health care is on the ballot this fall. I will work with my colleagues to stop the governor and an Iowa Republican ban on all abortions. I will also work to guarantee reproductive freedom by codifying abortion in the Iowa Constitution, as well as expanding access to reproductive health care in Iowa to both educate the public and prevent unplanned pregnancies. I continue to be passionate about renewing Iowa's commitment to being the best in the nation in education. I will work across the aisle to provide the necessary funding to make that happen. Providing adequate funding for class size reduction, teacher pay increases, programs to help with the increasing mental health and trauma-informed care necessary for student success, and reducing the learning gap. Once elected, I will be the only current educator in the Senate, giving them a new perspective. I look forward to the opportunity to serve in a broader capacity and putting Iowans first. That completes the Molly Donahue column. Jessica Wiskus, Iowa Senate District 42. Iowans share something fundamental. Voters may already recognize my name from local and national newspaper articles, webinars, or TV, film, and radio interviews. I am the Jessica from rural Lisbon who has been working with her neighbors to stand against eminent domain for the CO2 pipelines. I believe in protecting the integrity of our land, the safety of our communities, and the future of our planet. But my campaign for state senate is about something more. When I was a student at the University of Iowa, I came home one autumn evening to discover that my dad, who had always farmed alone, had had an accident. It was a neighbor who happened by, luckily, and drove him to the hospital. This was in the days before cell phones. Our family was so thankful that he was okay, though he lost most of his thumb. But what were we going to do about the harvest that remained in the field? He couldn't work, a risk for infection. A day later, our neighbors came. They came with combines, they came with tractors, they came with grain wagons, and they brought food, too. Fried chicken and baked beans and pies. So many pies. The entire harvest was completed in one day, and through their generous hearts, our neighbors transformed a difficult situation into a celebration. And so when I learned that my neighbors were being targeted for eminent domain, how could I fail to take action? Because I know, I have lived to learn that what matters in life is not each possession that we acquire, but each gift that we share. Our time, our effort, our faith, our trust, our vulnerability, and our deep respect for one another. We may disagree with each other on the issues that we face as a state. We may choose to stand on opposite sides of the fence, but we can set aside those differences when something important is at stake because we share something fundamental. We share respect. Respect without judgment, suspicion, respect for the unique gift of each other as beings. Des Moines, embroiled in bitter partisanship, has lost sight of this, but I still see it working in the hearts of the thousands of people I have met on the campaign trail. This is the Iowa that I will carry with me to the state Senate. Thank you for your support. That is the end of the WSGS article. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, October 5th, 2022. I'm your reader, Janet Griffith. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.